When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On the 8th of November, 1895, in a dimly lit laboratory in the German city of Würzburg, Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen, a middle-aged physicist with a distinctive long black beard, was deeply engrossed in his experiments with cathode rays. Tiny, negatively charged particles found in vacuum tubes that had already helped scientists understand electricity and inspired inventions like television. But Röntgen was about to make history with a different discovery. As he adjusted the settings of his cathode ray tube, he noticed something peculiar, a faint glow emanating from a fluorescent screen across the room, even though it was shielded from direct light. Intrigued, Röntgen cautiously approached the screen, his curiosity piqued. Despite obstructing the light, the glow persisted. Rushing back to the cathode ray tube, he conducted further experiments, his movements frenetic with excitement. As Röntgen observed the phenomenon, a revelation dawned upon him: the potential to see beyond the surface, to peer into the hidden depths of the human body. With renewed determination, he meticulously documented his findings, sketching diagrams and recording observations. In a moment of clarity, he decided on a name: X-rays. This discovery would revolutionise the world of medicine, marking the beginning of health tech. Welcome to Euronews Tech Talks, the podcast delving into the digital, technological and scientific landscape shaping Europe. I'm your host, James Thomas. In these episodes, we're meeting European health tech pioneers. They haven't stumbled upon X-rays by accident, but they are spearheading other breakthroughs, paving the way for the development of various medical technologies that are already impacting our lives. We start in London, the UK, with Dr. Nadine Hashasharam, founder and CEO of Proximy. She's pioneering the introduction of technology in a very traditional place, the operating room. Let's listen to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Dr. Nadine Hashasharam. I'm a reconstructive plastic surgeon and I'm the founder and CEO of Proximy.
And what is Proximy?
So Proximy is a digital platform that really enables us to turn analog environments like operating rooms and cath labs and other rooms in the hospital into digitally connected environments. What does that mean practically? That means basically we can turn operating rooms into connected rooms where people can virtually scrub in, collaborate, share best practices. We can turn these rooms into rooms that can collate information. All the cases are recorded and stored in a secure and compliant way. And we can create ways to activate knowledge from these rooms and turn these into smart and data-driven rooms. All that content information, we can start to extract insights and learnings that can help us think about how we address productivity, how we address quality and safety, how we address the workforce challenges and enhance and accelerate the learning and training of all healthcare workers across the system. And it's a future where hopefully our system can power every room to be connected, collaborative, and activated.
So you said you're a surgeon. Going back to your basics, what do you remember from the first time you entered an operating room and from your first surgery? What was that like?
It actually goes back to when I was 14. So I am originally Lebanese. I was born in San Diego. I moved to Lebanon when I was about 10. It was a country emerging from civil war, albeit it had a number of smaller little wars that happened in the interim as I lived there. And I was very affected by what I saw around me, seeing people suffering with morbidity of trauma and blast trauma and others. And I was very lucky to have been introduced to a family friend who was a reconstructive surgeon. And he happened to be going down to one of the camp hospitals that week to do some trauma reconstruction on children. And I guess back then you could join in an OR at the age of 14. So I said, do you mind if I join you? And I think he was probably startled that a 14-year-old wanted to go into the OR, but also intrigued. So he took me along and I spent the whole day watching him operate. I distinctly remember a case of a young 5 or 6-year-old who had a Burns contracture to her ankle, to her foot, which meant that she couldn't walk properly. And he was able to release all of that, use skin grafts and other cool ways to make it possible for her to walk. And that moment was just, I still remember all the, you know, all the senses, like what it smelled like, what it felt like, what the noise was like. And I remember rushing home to my mother that afternoon saying, I've decided, that's it. I want to be a reconstructive surgeon, because I was just so in awe of how the surgery could transform people's lives instantly. And I think that's probably why I chose reconstructive surgery as opposed to other types of surgery. Plastics is more of a restoring form and function specialty, probably less on the life-saving side, more on the life-changing side. And I just really love that ability to interface with patients and change their quality of life. And I never looked back. I went on that path at 14. I said, I'm going to be a surgeon, and here I am.
Was it not traumatic in some ways to see that as a 14-year-old girl?
I think, you know, it's, I think I was just so much more excited. And I sort of, I'm smiling a little bit because my teenage daughter now, who's 17 years old, also wants to be a medic and managed to do some observerships in our hospital. And I had the same concern that she'd be kind of feeling a bit sick or queasy on her first day in an OR. And she was equally as mesmerized and excited as I was. I almost am seeing myself in her. So I think when you're just so in awe of the potential of what that work can do, you can look beyond the blood and the cuts and the things that probably make people feel less comfortable. I mean, naturally, you have to be comfortable with blood, but I think you can look beyond that and see what the true potential is.
So fast forward a few years, you're a surgeon now. You've mentioned that in operating rooms, despite being, having the most expensive assets in a hospital, they're still quite analog and undigitalized. So they kind of create a sense of loneliness. Why do you think these places haven't evolved as much?
It's a really interesting question. I think, look, surgery is, as much as it is a sort of a vocation, a job, it's an apprenticeship. It's a very practical job. I mean, historically, I think if you look into the history of surgery, particularly in the UK, it was, you know, led by the barbers and others. It's a very hands-on career, and it's very entrenched in tradition. The see one, do one, teach one tradition. The hierarchy of the surgeon and the surgical teams, and so naturally they're often less. Less willing to sort of change the ways they do things, albeit we're innovating all the time on new ways to deliver great surgical care to patients. If you just look at the repertoire of procedures we do today versus what we did, 100 years ago, there's thousands of more surgeries that are available to patients. That being said, operating rooms are analog because they've been disparate. You know, we still count things by hand when we're at the scrub table. We might go to a computer to input some things into the electronic medical record. We might still do counts on a whiteboard. I might have a very fancy robot, but it's disconnected from the rest of the room. So you have a bit of a mishmash and a Frankenstein of systems and devices that don't all speak or work together. And so what happens is you just don't have an ability to correlate and aggregate this information knowledge in a meaningful way that can really stimulate an ability for you to even compare apples to apples, and how do we sort of structure meaningful data sets that help us look at quality, look at outputs, look at performance, look at patient outcomes, et cetera. And so expecting hospitals to gut all their equipment and put in a whole new hardware infrastructure is challenging because every hospital is very heterogeneous. But coming in as a vendor-neutral software and saying, we are going to be the operating system for you. We are going to be that middleware that threads the needle, that connects your devices your people, your processes, your information. And from that together, we can extract value was such a compelling sort of opportunity for us to think about. And the reason I think I set up Proxime and to try and address that wasn't because technology was front of mind for me. Although I have an affinity to technology, I played video games as a kid, my father was a computer engineer, so naturally was comfortable in that environment. But it really came from a pain point of the supply-demand pain point, the quality outcomes pain point. I spent 10 years in global surgery. I know, and as we all know, 5 billion people lack access to safe surgery. We also know that in health systems all around the world, including our own, there's a high amount of variability in surgical care. Where you go and where you access care often can determine what kind of care you get. And you only need to look to things like the NHS GERF program and others to get it right first time that are publishing these openly. And so it made sense to me that the way to, one, scale expertise and standardize and codify expertise meant that we needed to find that interplay and that intersection between healthcare and technology. And there was nothing out there. And so I felt it was my duty to try and solve for that.
So you've mentioned there that you have been always quite comfortable with technology. Have you encountered resistance from people who are maybe not so digital friendly, from other health professionals, perhaps?
Look, even within our own space, I mean, I remember when I first kind of thought of this concept or idea, I think it was 2012, 2013. And I was thinking, how am I going to walk into the OR next door and actually convince my colleagues that we're going to digitize their operating room? It just seemed so futuristic, so sci-fi. And for the first few years, as I would stand on podiums pitching this concept of the digitally connected OR, the smart OR, the intelligent OR, I definitely received some resistance and some pushback. But I knew in my heart of hearts that this had to be the way forward and that this was the way we would truly standardize and democratize access to surgical care. And so I needed to be very considered in the approach to market. What was going to be my wedge? What was going to be the first use case that would get people comfortable with digital operating rooms? If I'd gone in 2012 and said, we're going to capture all your data and we're going to analyze all your data and do all these great things, I might have faced quite a lot of resistance. But I went in and said, just simply imagine that by using your phone or your tablet or your computer, you could virtually scrub in to any operating room to share best practices, to share learnings, to support a colleague, to give a second opinion, to support a trainee who's on call in the middle of the night. That kind of ability to just share knowledge and education seemed like a really benign first wedge in. And so that's where we started. And I thought, if I can really build enough evidence and buy-in around the benefits of digital technology for education training, then from that we could unlock all the other use cases around data, content, medium, et cetera. And, knock on wood, that approach worked. And I think being a practicing surgeon, I still practice, also brought a lot of credibility. I'm not here telling people what to do when I'm not going through the same challenges and opportunities myself. And I'm not facing those day in, day out like everyone else does.
So can you give us an overview of the kinds of technology that Proxime is integrating into operating rooms?
Yeah, so today we are a software, we are hardware vendor neutral. So if we go into hospitals where they already have equipment in the room, our software just plugs into that. We're enabling the delivery of hubs and spokes of care, where you're having experts and peripheral centers all working together to deliver that best practice. We have the ability to capture all that knowledge and information to look at performance, review, advice, feedback, enhanced learning. So we've demonstrated that we can train twice as many doctors and nurses in half the time. And we are now leaning into those actionable insights to show how we can enhance productivity in operating rooms, how we can utilize that time more efficiently, how we can support in scheduling and making sure patients get their surgery at the right time. And then trying to correlate that with medical records and others as well. And we're still on the early days of that journey. But today we're in over 1,000 facilities. We've deployed our software in 60 countries. We're sharing best practices around the world. And we're helping medical device companies launch products more effectively in a more accelerated way and support the adoption of these technologies in a meaningful way too.
Can you give any examples of those medical devices you're helping to accelerate the production?
Yeah, I mean, there's numerous of them that obviously in the news, but, you know, things like an aquablation device for benign prostatic hypertrophy, a company we work with, we support them doing that. Robotics companies, knee robotics, supporting the adoption scale of total knee or partial knee robotics. We're doing it with companies that are coming to market with new robots around abdominal surgery, for example, gynecology surgery, hernia surgery, colorectal surgery. And equally, we're supporting it with upper GI, things like hiatus hernia repairs. So there's a whole host of companies that we work with, including imaging companies that are bringing new complex imaging devices into hospitals, companies that are doing life-saving catheter procedures for cardiac catheterization or neurovascular, supporting them in the management of stroke or cardiac disease.
Is there any way that you can incorporate virtual reality into this, VR?
What's interesting, you mentioned that. So Proximy has an element of augmented reality already in it. It's that sort of intersection of the computer world and the real world. And I think that's really meaningful when we think about the real-time OR environment. We're very passionate about the real-time environment and what we can do with it. Imagine a future as we start to enhance our technology of a real-time surgical co-pilot with you in the room, supporting with information about the patient's care, advice, et cetera, all within that environment. What I love about virtual reality, although it's not directly involved, even though we have used Oculus to have a sort of Proximy type experience with the Oculus, is really our mantra around how we need to modify training and education in surgical care. So training and education historically was see one, do one, teach one. Very analog, very siloed. Probably to some extent frightening that that's how surgical care, you know, surgical practice is adopted. And I very much believe that has to evolve to prepare, perform, perfect, a single continuum. And throughout your journey, we're continuous. At any point in your career, you're prepping for cases, which could be using Proximy to dial into a live case and get familiar with the procedure or observe some of the cases in the library. But could also be preparation through VR experiences. And there are some great technologies out there, great companies, which friends of mine have set up, looking at VR as a training module, not just for the procedure itself, but things like, how do I set up the equipment? How do we place the robot in the right place or the scrub table? When you then perform your cases, you can have someone through Proximy virtually scrub in with you, a proctor, a mentor, guide you through that case. And then when you perfect, you can go back and review your cases and watch them and get feedback or through some of the algorithms, get suggestions on what you might consider for future or how long your case took or who was involved in your case, et cetera, et cetera. But VR, I think, has a really good place in the preparation part of that angle. And there are some really great companies working in it.
So moving on then to another topic, I think you've mentioned before that Proximy applies concepts that are used in other fields, such as sports coaching, for example, and it applies them in the operating room. How does that work?
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at sporting, and obviously I love sports because I used to play soccer, or as we call it here, football and
I'm glad
volleyball.
You said that.
Yes, football and volleyball. I have to admit, I'm an Arsenal fan, so I hope people watching our Arsenal fans.
I'm a Liverpool fan myself.
But, you're okay. You know. You're okay. We still got that red color, so we're okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So the big thing, and particularly this was a big thing in swimming, and we're seeing it more in sort of team sports. It was a big thing with the NFL. Again, we see it more in other sports. Is the game tape, right? So think about the game tape. You're recording and capturing every angle of the game. Now, what value you're extracting from that varies from individual. If you're a defense coach, for example, you're going to be observing and looking at insights from that video in a very different way than if you're an offense coach. Each person can extract value from that, but it's an incredible objective source of truth in terms of how you coach and mentor in a very pragmatic and visual way, which in a way is very similar to surgery, is very visual. You need to find ways to extract objective sources of truth that help you remove bias and help you really enhance the way you give feedback. And so there's a lot of similarity, coaching, mentoring, and the game tape. And if you look back, I think it was 2016 or so, Atul Gawande, who's obviously a well-known physician who's written a lot about the WHO checklist, surgical practice, and others, actually wrote an article in The New Yorker on surgical coaching. And Caprice Greenberg, who is an incredible scientist physician out of Wisconsin, published a lot of data very early on the role of surgical coaching. And what Atul said is, you know, even though I am a senior consultant in my practice, I can still keep enhancing and improving. It's the same as you think about tennis, like a Federer still has a coach, still has someone saying, if you just moved your wrist 5 degrees, you might be able to, you know, make a big difference in your swing or your serve. Why wouldn't we want to do the same in surgery where the stakes are so high?
Are there any other fields that where, you know, you apply concepts from those fields into?
Absolutely.
Into
operating? I mean, look, the data revolution has already happened in the aviation industry and in the vehicle industry. When we look at with aviation, of course, everything is data tracked and driven. But this is why, and again, it's high stakes, but this is why we have such few never events, right? We're tracking everything. We're learning from it. It's designed to be constructive, not punitive. This is about how we learn and ensure that we reduce risk wherever possible. And it's risk management. As we look at the vehicle industry, you know, a lot of cars now have these trackers that are measuring a lot of information about individual risk. And I think that's important because there's an element of personalization to that. We can't say all obstetricians have X risk or all general surgeons have Y risk, but we can try and personalize that and personalize the learnings to an individual. And so those are industries where risk is important, safety is important, quality is important. That's not too dissimilar to healthcare. And why wouldn't we take on similar models? And we're not the first to look at that. I mean, healthcare has for a long time been modeling on some of the learnings from the aviation industry. And there was some great work that came out of Great Ormond Street Hospital several years ago now, led by Martin Elliott and others, where they were trying to look at models in the F1, McLaren sort of models of prepping for complex surgeries, seeing, you know, how they prep for races. How do we learn from that in sort of complex surgery? So we need to continue to learn from other sectors. We need to continue to be willing to adopt and innovate and change the way we do things. And Proxmi is definitely leading the category and leading the way in the digitization of surgery.
And is international cooperation improving through this as well? Have you noticed any or got any success stories from that you can share?
Yes. One story actually that's also dear to my heart is one that happened during COVID. We had in our own hospital a patient with metastatic testicular cancer, which was very unfortunate. He was young, very young patient. And he'd had all his chemo radiotherapy pre-surgery to shrink the tumor, and they were ready to operate on him. And normally in our hospital, they would have done an open procedure for him, but it was COVID, and they were extremely worried about the length of stay he would have to have after the surgery in the hospital, given he'd be immunocompromised after all the chemo and radiotherapy. But they knew that the world expert in this procedure robotically was based in Seattle. We have in our hospital here amazing robotic surgeons, but they hadn't really done this particular approach. And so he dialed in remotely. The surgeons worked together and they delivered this case for this patient robotically, which meant he was able to go home the next day, reducing his risk, enhancing his chances of survival. And I'm pleased to say that he's still with us in remission and is a huge advocate for these kinds of enabling technology. So a few stories, both from the LMICs and from, you know, the West, but globally, we're seeing this happening on a weekly basis.
That's absolutely incredible. And you just think when you hear stories like that, surely it will just, you know, encourage people to really invest in this and kind of, you know, make sure it's as widespread as possible.
It is. And because, again, I don't want people to think, oh, we're here pitching tech for tech's sake, because that's really not what we're trying to do. We're not a tech solution looking for a problem. We're not trying to insert tech perhaps where it doesn't need to be inserted. I call myself an accidental entrepreneur, which if we have time, I'll tell you about. But this was really born out of a pain that we needed. And we are addressing that every single day with this technology. So people are far more willing to be supportive, to embrace it, to champion it.
So I take it from what you're saying that, you know, you believe that health tech really is one of the key ways to leverage technology to really improve everyone's lives, basically, worldwide.
Yes. I mean, we have to be really honest. The kind of the historical model of sort of bricks and mortar healthcare, all centralized in big hospitals, is no longer fit for purpose from a cost perspective, from a scale perspective. And so we have to start to look at healthcare in a different lens. And that's not just about Proximy. That is about prevention. That is about virtual care, remote care, virtual wards. How do we start to decentralize care and bring it and make it more available locally?
So looking forward then, how can digitalized operating rooms have a positive impact on our lives in the coming years? You know, the short term, the medium term, and indeed the long term.
I think first and foremost, it's around access to safe and equitable surgical care. I think too, around the workforce, how do we enhance and accelerate the development of a workforce that's going to be available to treat the increasing demand? And you think about the 5 billion patients, we cannot organically create as many doctors and nurses do that. So we have to think differently. And as I said, we've already shown we can train twice as many doctors in half the time. And then finally, I think it's about productivity. How do we leverage existing infrastructure to deliver the most care possible? How do we enhance and alleviate some of the pain points in productivity? So our doctors aren't spending 40% of their time doing data entry and accident, but find ways where ambient and data-driven technology can do this in an automated way. So we can free up those doctors to see more patients, spend more time with their patients as needed, and enhance the productivity of their time with them. So I think it really stems around that kind of quality of access, workforce and training, and productivity. And those are the bits that are challenges that every health system is facing, no matter where you are in the world.
Well, I guess we'll see what will happen in the coming years. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. It sounds like an absolutely fascinating part of healthcare, of tech. Nadine Hashasharam, founder and CEO of Proximy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. In the upcoming episode, we'll meet Ida Tin, the founder of the menstrual tracker app Glue and the person who coined the term femtech. Can you imagine that before there was no word to refer to technology designed to improve women's health and well-being? And you know what Confucius said? The beginning of wisdom is the ability to call things by their proper names. I'm your host, James Thomas. This series is directed, written, and produced by Marta Rodriguez Martinez. The theme music is by Leo Lebrun. Sound editing is by Jean-Christophe Marcot, and sound mixing is by Mathieu Duchesne. Our editor-in-chief is Ali Issan Aydin. If you aren't already, you can listen to this series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and, of course, sharing it. Thanks for listening.